Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue to learn, we can actually improve in our appeals to heaven. So let's continue to learn. I want to kind of speed into the content, but I just want to say everything we're doing, the reason we're going through the ratification basis is so that we can understand what we're supposed to hold them accountable to, how it was defined. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole secret, folks. If you're ignorant of the law, then they can pretend what the law is, and they've been getting away with pretending their butts off. I mean, they've created this monster with pretending. That's why I keep on saying it's all fraud. So, they only have certain authorities. That's it. All right, so we're diving into the Virginia ratification debates, and I find this very illuminating. They're going to be getting into the level of details that, you know, they're different than Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and so forth. And there's a reason being, because they're actually showing you how they're focused in this area with different paradigms than what we see in other areas. So anyway, let's go. Go ahead. Now, actually, what we've got is we're going down to the next note under paper money. So there's a paper money, then there's a capital N lowercase note, and then there's another note that's all capitalized. Because Tammy just pointed out that I missed this, and so I've added a second note there, so don't worry about it. It'll be there when you pull it in to read it. So if you're using the current one. Now, I will just tell you that until we go through these things, I don't put the current ones up. But I will tell you that as of this next week, the South Carolina updates will be there, but the Massachusetts and the Pennsylvania updates are all there. So as we cover them and as we update them along, then we'll upload them so that you can come back. You can listen as we talk and discuss and read these ratification debates. So, okay. This is Governor Randolph, and this is January 6th, and he was kind of talking about paper money, and now let's find out what is of key interest that he's pointing out here. Go ahead.
Are we not taught by reason, experience, and governmental history that tyranny is the natural and certain consequence of uniting these two powers, or the legislative and judicial powers, exclusively in the same body? If anyone denies it, I shall pass by him as an infidel not to be reclaimed. Whenever any two of these three powers are vested in one single body, they must, at one time or another, terminate in the destruction of liberty. In the most important cases, the assent of 9 states is necessary to pass a law. This is too great a restriction, and whatever good consequences it may, in some cases, produce, yet it will prevent energy in many other cases. It will prevent energy which is most necessary on some emergencies, even in cases wherein the existence of the community depends on vigor and expedition.
Okay, so the point is that they don't want to make, they wanted to make sure that this government didn't have the power of the judiciary, executive, and legislative. This novel concept of basically breaking up the magistrate, this is new. This is so new that as we look at it right here, these guys have been talking about it for a little over a year since the Constitutional Convention. This is June. A year before this, this all became settled that when you allow the magistrate the power to create the laws, execute the laws, and determine whether their laws are being broken, that is the recipe of tyranny. Thus, they created a more perfect government by dividing those responsibilities. And so that's how liberty can be protected. So I think it's just this real point here is all about the essential nature of the separations of powers, especially when it comes to government or what we would call a magistrate. Remember, Continental Congress was the magistrate. It was just a body of people with equal voice from each state. It was so problematic that it's just not worth going into over and over and over again. But what they ended up doing was a much better system. So let's go back down. Let's go down to the next note then.
Okay. I'm afraid I have tired the patience of this house, but I trust you will pardon me, as I was urged by the importunity of the gentleman in calling for the reasons of laying the groundwork of this plan. It is objected by the honorable gentleman over the way, Mr. George Mason, that a Republican government is impracticable in an extensive territory, and the extent of the United States is urged as a reason for the rejection of this Constitution. Let us consider the definition of a Republican government, as laid down by a man who is highly esteemed. Montesquieu, so celebrated among politicians, says that a Republican government is that in which the body, or only a part of the people, is possessed of the supreme power, a monarchical, that in which a single person governs by fixed and established laws, a despotic government, that in which a single person without law and without rule directs everything by his own will and caprice. This author has not distinguished a republican government from a monarch by the extent of its boundaries, but by the nature of its principles. He, in another place, contradistinguishes it as a government of laws in opposition to others, which he denominates as a government of men.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The empire, or government of laws, according to that phrase, is that in which the laws are made with the free will of the people. Hence, then, if the laws be made by the assent of the people, the government may be deemed free. When laws are made with integrity and executed with wisdom, the question is whether a great extent of country will tend to abridge the liberty of the people. If defensive force be necessary in proportion to the extent of country, I conceive that in a judiciously constructed government, be the country ever so extensive, its inhabitants will be proportionably numerous and able to defend it. Extent of country, in my conception, ought to be no bar to the adoption of a good government. No extent on earth seems to be too great, provided the laws be wisely made and executed. The principles of representation and responsibility may pervade a large as well as a small territory, and tyranny is as easily introduced into a small as into a large district. If it be answered that some of the most illustrious and distinguished authors are of a contrary opinion, I reply that authority has no weight with me till I am convinced that not the dignity of names, but the force of reasoning gains my assent.
Okay. So sometimes when people create an argument, I'll give you a good example. Jordan Peterson. Brilliant man, but he talks a good game regarding all sorts of good things as a subject matter expert profoundly. But when he gets into governing and government, I think he marginalizes our Constitution because I know he doesn't understand it. Now, does he have to? No, he's a Canadian. I wouldn't even expect him to understand it. The problem is that he has an influence based, it's almost like affluence. It's almost like he has money, but he's got creds because so many people just love what he says. And to me, it doesn't hold weight. That's what he's saying. Let's move on.
Yeah. Okay, so this is, Mr. Madison then arose, but he spoke so low that his exordium could not be heard distinctly. I shall not attempt to make impressions by any ardent professions of zeal for the public welfare. We know the principles of every man will and ought to be judged not by his professions and declarations, but by his conduct. By that criterion, I mean, in common with every other member, to be judged. And should it prove unfavorable to my reputation, yet it is a criterion from which I will by no means depart. Comparisons have been made between the friends of this Constitution and those who oppose it. Although I disapprove of such comparisons, I trust that, In point of truth, honor, candor, and rectitude of motives, the friends of this system, here and in other states, are not inferior to its opponents, but professions of attachments to the public good and comparisons of parties ought not to govern or influence us now. We ought, sir, to examine the Constitution on its own merits solely. We are to inquire whether it will promote the public happiness. Its aptitude to produce this desirable object ought to be the exclusive subject of our present researches. In this pursuit, we ought not to address our arguments to the feelings and passions, but to those understandings and judgments which were selected by the people of this country to decide this great question by a calm and rational investigation. I hope that gentlemen, in displaying their abilities on this occasion, instead of giving opinions and making assertions, will condescend to prove and demonstrate by fair and regular discussion. It gives me pain to hear gentlemen continually distorting the natural construction of language, for it is sufficient if any human production can stand a fair discussion. Before I proceed to make some additions to the reasons which have been...
So let me interrupt you really quick, because he kind of talks about earlier, because I think he's really, in a way, poking people in the eye. Did you kind of get this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, very respectfully, but yes.
Yes, very respectfully. Because up above, he makes this comment, and rectitude of motives, because he basically says, I trust that in point of truth, honor, candor, and rectitude of motives. So in other words, everybody's driven by, what they're saying is driven by motives. What is the motive that's driving? Why are these people taking these positions? Because he says the friends of the system here and in other states are not inferior to its opponents. Okay, so then down right what you just read, I hope the gentlemen, in displaying their abilities on this occasion, instead of giving opinions and making assertions, will condescend to prove and demonstrate by a fair and regular discussion. It pains me to hear gentlemen continually distorting the natural construction of language, for it is sufficient if any human production can stand a fair discussion. So in other words, he's basically, this is what I've been saying, how the anti-federalists never really went into the nuts and bolts of the clause itself and how it was wrong. What they did was they said, well, they're not going to abide by this. They're going to break this. They're going to violate this. That's what they kept on doing. And right here, how early was this? This was June 6th. They started on the 3rd. It was the third day of the debates. And Madison said, you guys are just, contorting everything all on your own anyway. Let's actually start arguing and discussing the merits of the language and the actual clauses instead of distorting them. It's interesting. And you're also going to notice, because I highlighted a couple of times, how either Nicholas, Madison, or somebody on the Federalist side stands up and goes, why are we revisiting something? We've already gone through this. Why do you keep, picking at the scab? That's how desperate the anti-federalists were. And that's why when Madison was all done and said and the Constitution was ratified, that's why he used language like it was constantly justified as a limited and defined government. And it was. As we go through these ratification debates, folks, this is exactly what they're proving. And that's why Madison was capable of saying that, because guess what? He actually read the other ratification debates. It's not this. I tell people, I did not know this, but I had such a surety that I told people that you will find no contrast, no conflicts amongst what the Federalists were saying, what these lines meant. They may have used different words, but they were basically saying the exact same thing. And as I've gone through the ratification debate several times, I have actually assured, or basically I've just reaffirmed what I had, taken a wild ass guess on, because I didn't know for sure, but I was willing to make that leap of faith that there's no way that there's any conflicts in these ratification debates. The only place you find conflict is if you're reading the anti-federalist assertion and saying, well, that there you go. You can't. That's why when you moving forward, because the delegation ratified, they took and accepted what the Federalists said. So what else did they do? In the same motion, they rejected the arguments of the Anti-Federalists. I pointed this out with Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania did not include the Anti-Federalist arguments. I would be disingenuous if I edited through these things and removed the Anti-Federalist arguments. And I actually point out, like with Henry on the militia just earlier, that Henry was basically blowing smoke because he was contorting, you know, these principles that what he was talking about was legitimate when actually they would be violations of the Constitution. So why, you know, why even show those things? Because it actually supports what I'm trying to say. And actually, Madison is just reemphasizing this. And I've just gone into a long discourse to say, Madison just said it very eloquently, that these guys are not here actually talking about nuts and bolts. Their job is to throw bad ideas at you just so you can, you know, reject this thing so that we can, you know, fail as a union and go back to being independent states.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Before I proceed to make some additions to the reasons which have been adduced by my honorable friend over the way, I must take the liberty to make some observations on what was said by another gentleman, Mr. Henry. He told us that this Constitution ought to be rejected because it endangered the public liberty, in his opinion, in many instances. Give me leave to make one answer to that observation. Let the dangers which this system is supposed to be replete with be clearly pointed out. If any dangerous and unnecessary powers be given to the general legislature, let them be plainly demonstrated, and let us not rest satisfied with general assertions of danger without examination. If powers be necessary, apparent danger is not a sufficient reason against conceding them. He has suggested that licentiousness has seldom produced the loss of liberty, but that the tyranny of rulers has almost always affected it.
Yep.
Encroachment, it says, since the general civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. But on a candid examination of history, we shall find that turbulence, violence, and abuse of power by the majority trampling on the rights of the minority have produced factions and commotions which in republics have more frequently than any other cause produced despotism. If we go over the whole history of ancient and modern republics, we shall find their destruction to have generally resulted from those causes.
I mean, so he's really making an argument here that you have to basically tell us what is the problem. Don't just say, as he pointed out to Mr. Henry, who basically told us that it ought to be rejected because it endangered the public liberty. Well, okay, how specifically? Tell me specifically. And so they weren't doing that. And so as they tried to do that, then it started getting pointed out that, well, hold on here. What you're asserting is basically not in congruence to the Constitution. You're basically saying that the government is doing something under this Constitution legitimately, and that's actually what you're saying is actually a violation, not something that they have a legitimate power to do. So anyway, right. I mean, this is how it really went. And there were people, believe it or not, folks, there were people that refused to give up their biases. It was an agenda for them to try to preserve the status quo. It wasn't about many people who were selected. Now, I'll even say this, that the elections may have been to preserve the status quo. In other words, the people may have actually told their delegates, you know, I don't care what, I don't know what this new Constitution does. I don't care. I like what we got. Keep it. They may have been that, you know, ignorant. They may have been that imbecilic. The point is that these delegates, regardless of what their constituents told them, these delegates had the responsibility of debating the merits of the Constitution. And very few on the anti-federal side actually and objectively debated the merits of the Constitution. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, as Madison keeps on teaching and teaching, he gets into this concept of exclusive legislation. This is found in Article 1, Section 8, and it's, I think, subsection 16 or 17, where Congress shall have exclusive legislative authority over the said district. Go ahead.
He next objects to the exclusive legislation over the district where the seat of government may be fixed. Would he submit that the representatives of this state should carry on their deliberations under the control of any other member of the union? If any state had the power of legislation over the place where Congress should fix the general government, this would impair the dignity and hazard the safety of Congress. If the safety of the union were under the control of any particular state, would not foreign corruption probably prevail in such a state to induce it to exert its controlling influence over the members of the general government? Gentlemen cannot have forgotten the disgraceful insult which Congress received some years ago, when we also reflect that the previous session of particular states is necessary before Congress can legislate exclusively anywhere. We must, instead of being alarmed at this part, heartily approve of it.
So, okay, so this is kind of interesting as we kind of look at, and he doesn't point it out here. They actually bring it up a little bit later, where Congress actually had to flee their meeting and their session because the people of the state were pretty pissed off with what they were doing. They had no protection from that state. So when we go through all of this, this actually, we don't have a petition yet, but we need to have a petition that extrapolates why the seat of government, the District of Columbia, was to be controlled exclusively by Congress, not to have it another state, not to create a state, because now that state wants to control, and now they want to have that control. They want to have equality. No, they had to maintain autonomy. The idea of the district was to be autonomous from the parties of the compact so that no party could control them. Now Congress is creating a party. They want to create a government and then make it a party to the union so that they can be controlled by that party. Are you kidding me? That's how absurd and how ludicrous this cycle of illogic that they've been trying to actually throw themselves into the arms of some other power. Why? Because it's all about an agenda. And it's all about redefining everything. And the fact is that the only way Congress can actually create a state or a local government is they would have to amend the Constitution, where Congress would no longer have exclusive legislation. That it wouldn't be a secession of a state. It would be the ascension of a state. And that state would now actually become a state. And that right there that's why it requires an amendment, and the debate would be, I think it would be shot down, because everybody, when you go through how the ratification debates, how they identified these types of threats, where this new, our federal government could now be actually controlled and constrained by a state. That's why it was to be autonomous. Anyway, let's go into the militia. This is a response on the militia. Go ahead.
Okay, but the honorable member sees great danger in the provision concerning the militia. This I conceive to be an additional security to our liberty without diminishing the power of the states in any considerable degree. It appears to me so highly expedient that I should imagine it would have found advocates even in the warmest friends of the present system. The authority of training the militia and appointing the officers is reserved to the states. Congress ought to have the power to establish a uniform discipline throughout the states and to provide for the execution of the laws.
So, unfortunately, we ran out of time. So we're going to have to pick this up. The authority of the training of militia, blah, blah, blah. From right at that point, I'll cue Tammy in. But anyway, I'm sorry, folks. We will get right back to this when we come back from this promo. Please stay tuned. This is about the militia now. Again, one of everybody's favorite topics today. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, sorry about that. We kind of moved into a couple sentences here, and you got trampled on when you got into the authority of training the militia and that part right there. So let's pick it up from there. But here's the interesting thing, because you're going to read a part right at the end of the page going into the next page that I'm going to want to kind of interrupt when you're done, because this is gold right here. Go ahead.
Okay. The authority of training the militia and appointing the officers is reserved to the states. Congress ought to have the power to establish a uniform discipline throughout the states and to provide for the execution of the laws to suppress insurrections and rebel invasions. These are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia, and the obvious necessity of their having power over them in these cases must convince any reflecting mind.
Right there. Right there. Okay, so what did he just say? Congress shall have the power to provide for the execution of the laws, suppress insurrections, and repel invasion. He goes on and says, these are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia in creating a federal army. And the obvious necessity of having power over them. I mean, see, when people just kind of read over that, that one little stanza, these are the only cases wherein they can interfere with the militia. Do you need it in any other way? Or they would have enumerated it in Article 1, Section 8, to go fight wars to protect our friends. You know, our international friends, to preserve liberty for our international friends. I can tell you, if that was in the Constitution, that we would have had to go fight wars on foreign soil, because we were friends, you know, they could drag us into war. I think the Constitution would have been rejected.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. So how is it that we're doing these things? They don't have the authority. Madison said it right here. These are the only cases they can actually call forth the militia, the ground forces. In other words, we have a Navy and Marine Corps, an expeditionary force to basically protect our interests, but not really to get involved and wage war with, you know, other nations. That was never the design. See? Does it exist? There's your smoking gun right there. They cannot engage the army for globalism or, you know, for the cause of, you know, partial liberty in Germany. Anyway, okay, so pick it back up with uniformity of discipline and so forth. Thank you.
Okay, without uniformity of discipline, military bodies would be incapable of action. Without a general controlling power to call forth the strength of the Union to repel invasions, the country might be overrun and conquered by foreign enemies. Without such a power to suppress insurrections, our liberties might be destroyed by domestic faction and domestic tyranny be established.
So let me ask you this. He just said, without a general controlling power to call forth the strength of the Union to repel invasions,
the country might be overrun and conquered by foreign enemies. Is he talking about an armed force? Is he talking about being overran by a bunch of armed combatants? No. To be a foreign enemy can be somebody that is deliberately invading you to take over. I.e., have you ever heard, this is in the petition, there is in the hadiths of Islam, there is a doctrine of using migration in mass migration into a country to overpower them. That is a doctrine of Islam. Are they going in with guns? No, they're going in with multiple wives, creating large families, and then overpowering the people and taking over. That's how Persia was destroyed, and the faith or the religion of the Zoroastrian faith was destroyed by Islam. Most people think, Persia was always Islamic. No, they weren't. They actually had their own faith. They were Zoroastrians. See, understanding history is pretty important. And so if you actually read the petition on the invasion, I point all of these things out in that petition. The Zoroastrian overrunning and so forth. The framers were very well aware of what invasions can do. They don't have to be a military invasion. They can be a political invasion. They can be a cultural invasion. It doesn't matter. It challenges and it threatens our own security, period. Invasions must be repelled. Any kind, whatever, repelled. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. The honorable member then told us that there was no instance of power, once transferred, being voluntarily renounced. Not to produce European examples, which may probably be done before the rising of this convention, have we not seen already in 7 states, and probably in an 8th state, legislatures surrendering some of the most important powers they possessed? But, sir, by this government, powers are not given to any particular set of men. They are in the hands of the people, delegated to their representatives chosen for short terms, to representatives responsible to the people, and whose situation is perfectly similar to their own. As long as this is the case, we have no danger to apprehend. When the gentleman called our recollection to the usual effects of the concession of powers and imputed the loss of liberty generally to open tyranny, I wish he had gone on farther. Upon his review of history, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions, from local considerations, which eternally led to quarrels. He would have found internal dissensions to have more frequently demolished civil liberty than a tenacious disposition in rulers to retain any stipulated powers.
Okay, so hold up here. Thank you. I was doing 3 things at once. So I'm re-highlighting the very last part of that. And as a matter of fact, I'm changing from when the gentleman recalled our recollection. Right. From that point on, I've changed the font to red and bold, because what he's saying here is really, really important. When the gentleman called our recollection to the usual effects of the concessions of powers and imputed the loss of liberty general to open tyranny, I wish he had gone further. Upon his review of history, he would have found that the loss of liberty very often resulted from factions and divisions. In other words, divide and conquer. In other words, if we can't unite and we can't be unified in resolve of demanding full compliance of the Constitution, we can literally be destroyed. And folks, how many times do you hear me say this? Look at the Patriots and how well they've divided us. From abortion, Second Amendment, education, healthcare, I could go on and on and on. There is, the Convention of States, that's another faction. Now we actually have a new faction in Washington State that's taken why counties matter most and tried to create a convention of counties, and focus on a myopic issue of convention of counties, like the Convention of States. It's all misleading. It's divisive. It has nothing to do with full compliance. If we're not united on full compliance of the Constitution, we are being destroyed. That is the solution. Correct me if I'm wrong. Please, folks, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm wasting everybody's time if I'm wrong. And the fact is that the full compliance of the Constitution is the only solution. Therefore, anybody that is doing something that is not demanding full compliance is a part of the problem. It's basic math. You're either a part of the solution or you're a part of the problem. Take your pick. And so if you want to chase a myopic issue, Second Amendment, it doesn't matter, whatever it is, then you're a part of the problem. And how many of these groups, like Tactical Civics, or, you know, these other conservative organizations that are not demanding full compliance? John Birchers, I haven't poked you guys in the eye for a while. You know, all of these different organizations that are failing to say we all need to unite. We need to put aside our differences, and we need to put aside our self-interest, our organizational interests, and say we need to demand full compliance of the Constitution and start holding these guys accountable to their oath by demanding their immediate removal by using the full force of the Constitution, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Prove me if I'm wrong, folks. And so this isn't really about me being the answer. I'm not. I mean, I I consider myself in some ways a good messenger for certain people, but sometimes I know I just rub people wrong. And, you know, sometimes people rub me wrong. We all have our little idiosyncrasies. You do get the, you know, there are personality conflicts, or, you know, oil and water, right? You just can't get these two to mix. You know, regardless of how much they think alike, they're still oil and water. They just can't get there. We all have to figure out what it takes to get there, because we have to put aside our differences and we have to put aside our self-interest. This is one of the reasons why I tell you there's no money in this. This is one of the reasons why these organizations that actually you pay for membership, you pay into, there's money involved in the organization. They're likely not to want to get involved because there's no money in doing this. We solve the problem, their organization goes away. So who's the real problem? And in essence, we are, because we're allowing ourselves to be divided. We need to start standing up and calling out all these groups to say, you're the problem. Either you unite on full compliance with the Constitution, using these petitions and getting organized at the county level and demanding full compliance of all of our public servants, blah, blah, blah. I mean, all these things we're doing. Tell me we're not doing these things and show me what we need to do. Don't come and tell me, don't come and give me old archaic government forms like, you know, citizens' grand juries and those. That's not applicable under our Constitution. The citizens do not have a right to form their own grand jury. We have a representative government. We have to go to our representatives. That was a part of our monarchical theocracy. And there were reasons for that being granted to the citizens, because that was their only way of opposing oppression. We don't have that. Our oppressors, we create our own oppressors. They're not rich. They're not, I shouldn't say, they're not royalty. They're not aristocrats. We're putting them in office. We got to take them out of office and put people in that'll actually serve us. Anyway, I apologize. This last section, though, this really does stupefy and actually gets right to the whole point that we're being divided. We're being conquered, folks, and we're allowing this to happen. Okay, so let's go back into this next one, militia. This is all red and yellow. This is hot stuff. Go ahead.
Okay. The power of raising and supporting armies is exclaimed against as dangerous and unnecessary. I wish there were no necessity of vesting this power in the general government. But suppose a foreign nation to declare war against the United States. Must not the general legislature have the power of defending the United States? Ought it to be known to foreign nations that the general government of the United States of America has no power to raise and support an army, even in the utmost danger, when attacked by external enemies? Would not their knowledge of such a circumstance stimulate them to fall upon us? If, sir, Congress be not invested with this power, any powerful nation prompted by ambition or
avarice
will be invited by our weakness to attack us, and such an attack by disciplined veterans would certainly be attended with success when only opposed by irregular, undisciplined militia. Whoever considers the peculiar situation of this country, the multiplicity of its excellent inlets and harbors, and the uncommon facility of attacking it, however much he may regret the necessity of such a power, cannot hesitate a moment in granting it. One fact may elucidate this argument. In the course of the late war, when the weak parts of the Union were exposed, and many states were in the most deplorable situation by the enemy's ravages, the assistance of foreign nations was thought so urgently necessary for our protection that the relinquishment of territorial advantages was not deemed too great a sacrifice for the acquisition of one ally. This expedient was admitted with great reluctance even by those states who expected advantages from it. The crisis, however, at length arrived when it was judged necessary for the salvation of this country to make certain cessions to Spain. Whether wisely or otherwise is not for me to say, but the fact was that instructions were sent to our representatives at the court of Spain to empower him to enter into negotiations for that purpose. How it terminated is well known. The fact shows the extremities to which nations will go in cases of imminent danger, and demonstrates the necessity of making ourselves more respectable, the necessity of making dangerous cessions and of applying to foreign aid ought to be excluded.
Okay, so here he's pointing out that the only way, because we couldn't get an army, because we didn't have the expertise via the militia because of the standards, because we didn't have a general government that was establishing those standards and arming and equipping and preparing the militia to be at the call at any point in time. We did not have a well-oiled defense system. And so we had to go to France. We had to go to Spain. We even went to Holland for money. And those, some of those things were just literally loans, debts. So when we examine the importance of the militia, one cannot underscore the importance of the federal government directly funding the arming, the training, and the disciplining so that the states have the appropriate money to do that. Today, because the federal government has assumed full control, that's why the Marine Corps has two bases of boot camp, Parris Island and San Diego. Technically, every coastal state should have a boot camp for act because, well, that's the militia. So the federal government can do the Navy and the militia. Let's put that aside. Not the Navy and the militia, the Navy and the Marine Corps. The militia has to be done by every state respectively. So each state has to train their own to have these centralized boot camps so that they just go there. That's unacceptable. And why? Because these other states that become the training ground get the benefit and the finances from the federal government. The other states are being starved. Plus, the other states actually all of a sudden, you know, start looking differently to say, you know, either we're not in the limelight or we don't want to have that. It doesn't matter whether you want it or whether you do or don't want it. It doesn't matter. Either way, I'm even confusing myself. Bottom line is you have a responsibility to be involved. Mm-hmm. And so many of the states like Massachusetts, they basically abjured themselves from being involved after the Dick Act. They said, we're not going to have an unorganized militia. We're allowing the federal government all this power. And it was unconstitutionally done. Instead of defending the Constitution, Massachusetts turned their back in 1903 when the Dick Act came out. This is how far we've gone as a nation. This is why it is not whether, you know, you like it or you don't like it. It doesn't matter. You have a responsibility. Just like every citizen can be called up and made compelled to use deadly force to defend that Constitution, barring your conscientious objection. If you conscientiously object, you won't be forced to kill people, but you may be forced to still serve by becoming a medic, by doing something else. You cannot have this responsibility removed. It's kind of like, you know, being a child of God. We have responsibilities, folks. We may get away with not fulfilling them, but one way or the other, we're going to be held accountable. And whether that comes in the next world or this world, I would rather be prepared to be accountable in this world so that I know I'm going to be accountable in the next. Bottom line, again, this is all about responsibility. And this is a long discourse, right? Madison's still going. He's not done. You keep going down, and now we hit jurisdiction. So go ahead and let's get into the jurisdiction.
Okay. I confess to you, sir, were uniformity of religion to be introduced by the system, it would, in my opinion, be ineligible. But I have no reason to conclude that uniformity of government will produce that of religion. This subject is, for the honor of America, perfectly free and unshackled. The government has no jurisdiction over it. The least reflection will convince us there is no danger to be feared on this ground.
Right, so the government has no jurisdiction regarding any aspects of religion. So how is it that they basically mandated that science, evolution, is the only thing to be taught, and we can't teach creation and the natures of man and God? What? See, this is how they've gotten out from underneath these hard boundaries, because it was clearly stated they couldn't be involved at all in religion. And now they're going around shutting down states. Oh, you can't have a cross on your hill. Oh, you can't have the Ten Commandments, because that's considered an establishment. That was never applied to the states. The Establishment Clause was only applied to the federal government. Remember, when we look, let me explain this. When we look at the 14th Amendment, no state shall make or enforce. This is the Bill of Rights and all things that have been added to the Constitution that guarantee citizens privileges and or immunities. That's what they call them, privileges and immunities. Some people just call them rights. So the privileges and immunities that are listed either in the original organic 17 articles or in any of the amendments, if there is a privilege or immunity listed, 14th Amendment states, no state shall make or enforce any privilege or any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of any U.S. citizen. So in other words, they can't make any law that abridges your right of religious expression. The question is the Establishment Clause a privilege or immunity guaranteed to a citizen? No. Every person can establish their own religion, but the state can also have a religion. They just can't deny your right of religious expression and your right of religious worship and so forth. I mean, they can't force you to be a part of this religion, but they can use a religion to perform certain functions, like education. Now, when the state started giving up, because that's exactly how education was managed, when the state started giving that up, they created a vacuum, and that's where the godless came in. They rushed in and said, okay, now we're going to create a godless, you know, education system, and we're going to attack God. Or actually, it wasn't attacking God, they were attacking Christ. Because this is when the federal government was being overran by basically Antichrist advocates, and the federal government ultimately became the Antichrist Church, because they literally started attacking Christ. They didn't create a church with brick and mortar, but what they did was they basically said, thou shalt not have your Christ over us. That's how profound it was. And so when the Supreme Court started ruling and shutting down any talk of Christ, any mention of prayer, any, you know, kneeling and bowing of the head in schools or what have you, thou shalt not have any God greater than us. And that's when they really crossed the line. That's when they actually created the Antichrist Church. So yeah. Anyway, powerful stuff. But, you know, only in America, only in America. See, let's keep going. We got 3 minutes, so let's be mindful of where we are.
Okay. So we're on amendments and state structure. It says, but we are flattered with the probability of obtaining previous amendments. This calls for the most serious attention of this House. If amendments are to be proposed by one state, other states have the same right and will also propose alterations. These cannot but be dissimilar and opposite in their nature. I beg leave to remark that the governments of the different states are in many respects dissimilar in their structure. Their legislative bodies are not similar. Their executive are more different. In several of the states, the first magistrate is elected by the people at large, and others by joint ballot of the members of both branches of the legislature, and in others in other different manners.
Okay, so remember yesterday, they were talking about this in South Carolina. They were talking about how different each of the government structures were. Madison's basically doing the same thing here. Okay, keep going.
This dissimilarity has occasioned a diversity of opinion on the theory of government, which will, without many reciprocal concessions, render a concurrence impossible. Although the appointment of an executive magistrate has not been thought destructive to the principles of democracy in many of the states, yet in the course of the debate we find objections made to the federal executive. It is urged that the president will degenerate into a tyrant. I intended, in compliance with the call of the honorable member, to explain the reasons of proposing this constitution and develop its principles, but I shall postpone my remarks till we hear the supplement which he has informed us he intends to add to what he has already said.
Okay, so obviously there's this dialogue going back. It's kind of like this living dialogue, dynamic, right? He's saying something, Madison responds, okay, I'm going to give it to you. And so Madison basically pointed out, okay, he said he's going to give it to us, so let's wait. Let me, because Madison is truly a gentleman. And as a matter of fact, he's a very small gentleman. He's a guy that really couldn't defend himself very, very good. Now, I'm not sure if he became really good with the draw, you know, for duels and so forth, but I just never saw him to be that kind of man. I think that his prowess was his intellect, and I think that he had the ability to insult people without them even knowing or understanding in some cases. But in dealing with really well-educated and intellectual people, Madison still maintained a civility that kept him out of that. He was our smallest president ever, the smallest in stature. He was probably the weakest because of health problems. I mean, he would never probably been elected today because of his, you know, the health standards and everything else. Well, okay, Biden didn't get elected, though. Okay, so anyway, the bottom line is that we kind of look at these discussions going back and forth and how they've talked about, you know, this president becoming a tyrant. The president can't create law. He has no authority regarding law other than negative law. One of the things that I would love to, and I think the Constitution needs eventually, is the ability to have flagged any kind of law or any type of action as unconstitutional. Therefore, it wouldn't just be a veto override. If it is identified as unconstitutional, the Congress can't go and do a veto override. That's done. It's over. The argument is done. Go away. That is unconstitutional. That would have killed all of that, and that would have been, I think, a critical add to the Constitution that they didn't have. But all that being said, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Tammy, for joining us. We'll dive back into the rest of this. We got a lot to go. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.